You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. We've been putting out a lot of coronavirus stories over the past few weeks, but this week we're taking a break from all of that. Something I've been doing when I'm trying not to think about the pandemic is watching a lot of violent and gory television. We're all feeling uncomfortable at the moment, and I've been struggling to make sense of that discomfort. The pandemic is just too big to comprehend. But watching Jodie Comer brutally murder someone with a hairpin on Killing Eve? Yeah, that's uncomfortable for sure, but I can comprehend it. It gives me somewhere to place all of these feelings, which makes them feel manageable. Something about watching intense situations unfold from the comfort of my couch helps me to forget about the real and complex hellscape that we're all living through. If you feel the same, this episode is for you. We're bringing you gory tales of death, murder, and lost appendages. First up, Jill goes on a date. A content warning, this episode contains swears.
This is my partner, Sam.
Hi, I'm Sam.
I met Sam about a year and a half ago on OkCupid.
Sam had like a really cute photo where he was wearing like a fake fur jacket and a little tiara.
With the dog staring at me.
Yes!
Yeah, I think it was the moment when we were chatting where he started talking about board games. And I was like, all right, here we go. She seems really good.
This nerd here.
Yep. It was a lot of fun. Sam was and still is this kind-hearted weirdo who gets excited about games and trying new things, so you can understand that I was pretty keen to keep dating this nerd. So, there I was, on a third date with Sam.
I was definitely nervous. I tried to dye my hair purple earlier that day, gotten dye everywhere, had a big old freak out, finally got all the purple dye off my body. Then went on this date and was like, I've had my mishap for today, it'll be fine.
Little did you know.
I was having trouble deciding on what we should do, but in the end we decided to see Bad Bangs at the Penny Black. I'd never been there before, but it seemed like your average student dive, with a comfortable level of grime. We watched them play and then decided to grab some beers in between bands. Everything was going fine. Just how you would like it to on a date. Lots of flirting, suggestive side-eye, hand-holding. All until we decided to go and sit at some benches in the room behind the bar area. That's when it happened. As I was scooting my seat into the bench, the tip of my finger slipped between the seat and the metal frame. The chair cut through my finger like a cheese slicer. The top of my middle finger had been chopped right off. There was a lot going through my mind.
This is the situation. I don't have the end of my finger anymore. Where did it go? I can't see it on the ground. It must be in the chair. Lifted the seat of the chair back up and was like, yep, there it is. And picked it back out of the chair and put it in my palm. That was the grossest part, honestly.
Well, then you continued to cling on to that finger for dear life.
Yeah, well, I was like, I want them to stick it back on. But that wasn't... It wasn't enough of it.
They don't have that sort of glue.
Yeah, it was very smooshed.
As you'd expect, I wasn't super happy about Sam seeing my actual bones only three dates in. However, he thought I'd just gotten a small, superficial cut, and he ran off to the bar to get a Band-Aid before I could even do or say anything.
I saw blood out of the corner of my eye and went, oh, well, I'll go get a plaster, so I quickly run off to the bar and... I come back with just a sticking plaster and you're there standing there holding your wrist with your hand up and like the top bit of your fingers off. And I'm going up with it. This isn't enough. This isn't enough.
I cradled my smooshed fingertip in my hand and I tried not to bleed on my dress. Sam sculled his drink and what with being a bit distracted by my own now visible section of skeleton, I regret to say that I left my expensive beer behind. We ran from the bar to our Uber with a polite but very confused driver who dropped us at the emergency for the women's hospital.
Yeah, I jumped in the back seat and he was like, whoa.
What's going on? Just seemed a lot like the Uber driver hadn't quite clicked that, oh, right, this is a bit of a, like...
Yeah, because
it's an emergency. We're going to the hospital for reason.
At the time, I didn't realize how much I appreciated that Sam was there for the ride.
I was pretty focused on my bleeding finger.
Like, it was like a steady drip. It wasn't like it was splurting blood everywhere or anything. But
no.
I did have to, like, cut one hand underneath it to catch the blood so I wouldn't bleed on the Uber. That was on my mind as well. It was like, don't bleed on the Uber.
Who even knows what the fee is for bleeding in an Uber? It's something like $60 for vomiting. And part of me thinks blood is worse.
It'd be the same. But also, is it really your responsibility for bleeding on the Uber? Somebody else has made you bleed.
Yeah, but it's my blood.
Are you responsible for your own blood?
I don't see anyone else bleeding in here.
When we arrived at the Royal Women's Hospital, the triage nurse kindly explained that fingers weren't an exclusively women's feature. So we then jogged over to the emergency room at the Royal Melbourne Hospital instead. There, I was given some Panadol and a sandwich bag full of ice for the end of my finger, since I refused to let the triage nurse put it in the bin. I think she was trying to hint that they were not going to be able to put it back on. But I was not ready to hear that information yet. I was still hoping that they would just glue it back on and Sam and I could go home together. Our date continued in the emergency waiting room for several hours. Here's Sam and I again.
I very much appreciated you being like, you're really cute.
Yeah.
When I'm sitting there with like my hand all bandaged up and the end of my finger in a sandwich bag with some ice. And you're like, you're really cute. And then we'll have like a cheeky pash.
Turns out that having someone tell you that you're cute and give you kisses while you're holding a small bit of yourself in a bag will make you feel kind of better. When we were finally brought through to see the doctor, Sam was still there. I was really glad he stuck around. It was nice to have a distraction, and he's a nice distraction to have. They ended up finding me a bed, and Sam went home at about 2 a.m.
Did you want to bail before that?
No. I didn't want to just leave it with, I don't know what's happening to Jill. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, definitely wanted to stay until you'd seen somebody and you knew what was going on.
So how did you feel about continuing to date me after all of that?
I was quite excited to go see you again, find out what happened to the finger. Also, I mean, after that night, we were quite well bonded. And I saw you at the next date. It was like meeting a friend at that point. It was like we'd known each other for a while.
I was in the hospital for 2 nights. I was very low priority on the surgery waiting list, and I had to take a week off work for my finger to heal enough for me to use it. I'm really lucky, though, because I didn't end up damaging my nail bed. Unless you look closely, you can't tell that some of my finger is missing. The next time I saw Sam, he invited me over to play board games at his house.
I think I was really nervous until we actually started playing games and I saw you and then I realised you were still really keen. But I think that went really well. I remember leaving and you like ran out of the house to give me like a cheeky pash before I got on the tram.
It's been over a year now and Sam and I are still together. I think this whole experience did help us bond in a way, but it's not something I'd go through again.
No.
No.
It's not something you intentionally do.
That story was produced by Gillian Langford. The supervising producer was Aaron Dick. In our next story, a group of kids stumble upon something small and vulnerable, left alone in the bush.
In our old suburb, which existed at the dawn of dial-up, time was a small thing. Most of the local kids spent long afternoons pinballing from door to door, down avenues dotted with one-story shacks, hollering for fellow hooligans to come out and bike, wrestle and spit. Alyssa and I, along with Jamie Kay from Number 9, didn't run with our peers. Firstly, because we're Cantonese, and the Shanghainese kids thought we stank of century egg and ate dog for dinner. Secondly, because nobody else was brave enough to wander into the bush. What's the difference between mandarins and clementines? Jamie Kay asked one afternoon, while he pushed aside dry foliage, ready to forage for Waratah shoots. He was peeling the fruit his mother gave him, ripping off tiny orange chunks and scattering them behind us in the dirt. The first time he did this, I shot him a questioning look. "Breadcrumbs," he said, grinning, "in case we have to run back home from a dingo or a hobo." "Mandarins are baby versions of oranges," Alyssa said in her prissiest voice, "and clementines are baby versions of mandarins. They're like the smallest piece of a fruity babushka doll." "A baby what now? Babushka, idiot. Those Russian dolls that you open up and find smaller copies inside." "Bro, I think clementines and mandarins are the same thing," I said. "What does a little runt like you know?" Alyssa sneered, flicking her ink spill of hair right in my face, hard. "I'm the one in year six. My sister and I have roughhoused everywhere in that piece of bush, along every inch of the creek, by the half-finished dog park, amongst the shredded remains of waterproof canvas that previously sheltered the homeless. There wasn't a single patch of earth that didn't have an imprint of my face slammed into it." One of Alyssa's bitchy comments would typically be my cue to reach into her roots, grab a handful and yank, until she was howling and ruddy with fury. Alyssa steeled herself, gaze predatory. Jamie Kay stepped back a bit, chewing on a nub of clementine, accustomed to our shit by now. "Chill, both of you," I snapped. "We're about to cross the bridge." There could be no fighting on the bridge. Bridges were sacred in our grandmother's stories, the zenith of the living world, only to be crossed carefully, if at all. Woods were sacred too, crawling with bone-faced spirits and cow-faced reapers, who could sniff out hero blood and steal their skin away. Alyssa's favourite hero is Wu Song, who wandered into the woods, absolutely wasted, and managed to beat a wild tiger to death with a staff. I think she admired his blatant disregard for anything holy. Maybe that's why she would pick up every giant branch she encountered, slashing confidently at the undergrowth. Of course, the woodlands we knew weren't the undying, lush forests from our bedtime yards. It was coarse and arid, filled with the smell of eucalypts and ant-eaten bird carcasses. There was a constant, unnerving buzzing, probably flies or cicadas, but the sliver of uncertainty made us sweat. These individual parts may have been ugly, sure, but the bush was as immense and arcane as the storybook trees that lived in our collective imagination. It had its own hidden dangers. The week before, Jamie Kay had spotted a red-bellied black snake lurking by the reeds, and once, Eugene Tran wandered too far across the bridge, wearing only jelly sandals. He had pierced his foot on a stray syringe. Allegedly, he ended up tripping for like 5 hours in the ER. "Jesus, what's that stink?" Jamie Kay asked when we were halfway across the bridge. The metal was groaning with each step, seemingly held together just for us. At either side flowed the creek that bisected the entire bush, littered with mammy noodle packets and ditch shopping trolleys, barely submerged beneath a film of coagulated moss. As Jamie Kay said, the air was thick, with a familiar, putrid stench. Ma liked to kill her household pests with rat poison, because she's non-confrontational like that. So I was used to the game of tracking down decomposing mammals by smell. There was an edge to the scent of rotting meat, a sharp, dissonant sweetness that was the first note to invade your nostrils. By the time we crossed the threshold and reached the clearing, we spotted what it was. Shaded by a dense cluster of gums, over a nest of desiccated leaves, was a dead mongrel. She looked like a terrier with vague accents of a million other European pedigrees. A medium-sized dog with a swollen belly and patches of wiry amber fur. Every inch of her was covered in writhing sow bugs, dry blood, and hodgepodge missing chunks. "That's disgusting," Jamie Kay said impassively. "Our neighborhood was plagued with roadkill on the regular, which the council took its sweet time cleaning up. The sight of smeared fur and guts was just as part of our neighborhood as jaywalking and teenagers secretly sipping VB near banh mi stands." "Wait, holy shit, look under it." Beneath the dog were 5 miniature versions of it. Babushka pieces. Dead little babushka pieces, half-formed and pink, their veins a startling blue from deoxygenation. Like their mother, the puppies were missing chunks of skin, probably having been feasted on by bush terrors. Holding our noses, we turn to leave, but the bodies in front of us are abruptly shifted. Something burrowed out from beneath the mud, the stink, and the pounds of flesh. "Oh," Alyssa said, an odd note of laughter in her voice. "It's the runt, just like you." The puppy was the size of my fist. I'll always remember it, the way she looked up at me when I crouched down, her tiny rosebud tongue lolling as if she had no awareness of the wreckage of carrion surrounding her. Her high-pitched staccato yelps chanting, "I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive." "It probably has rabies," Jamie Kay exclaimed. "Rabies aren't a thing in Australia, dickhead," Alyssa said. Her eyes may have been wide and fearful, but she still couldn't resist being right. "Well, it's got something. It's a cannibal. Wait, is that right? Is there a dog version of the word cannibal?" Alyssa and Jamie Kay's ping-ponging exchanges were distant. All I could focus on was the creature cupped between my palms, mewling. I brought her against my chest, feeling her blood-coated maw move restlessly against my favourite Winx Club TV shirt, marking it as her own. Beneath the matted pelt of mud and drying lacerations, I made out a white patch blooming across her face, unfurling around her guiltless, dark eyes. It looked like a flower. I decided to call her Hua. Giving her a Chinese name meant Ma was more likely to let me keep her.
That story was written and performed by Claire Cow and produced by Danny Stewart, with sound design by Ellie Freeman. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. I usually try to deal with unwanted bugs in the most humane way possible. Catch and release. Except for caterpillars. I hate caterpillars. The house that I grew up in had a white cedar tree in the backyard, and every year in the middle of autumn, the furry caterpillars would come. They would crawl down the tree, seemingly from nowhere, and make their way into every part of my life. My shoes, my laundry basket, my kitchen, and then one day, one of them crossed the line. I walked into my bedroom, and there it was. I couldn't take it anymore. I stomped it immediately, smushing it into the carpet. I took a sigh of relief. Not today, caterpillar. But then it kept moving. I could see its insides. It shouldn't have been able to go anywhere, but there it was, crawling along the ground. I was terrified. I lay down a piece of paper towel and then stacked a meter-high pile of books on top of it. I couldn't sleep all night. There was a demonic caterpillar under a stack of books in my bedroom. In our next story, Ryan and his housemates discover a pest that also refuses to meet its end. A heads up that this story is pretty gory.
I think the first thing that I noticed from time to time was footsteps in the ceiling.
This is Josh.
We had a pretty good idea that there was something kicking around in the house.
I remember seeing something moving, and the beginning was like, okay, there's something in the kitchen, but I couldn't see what was it. It was just like a little shadow. And then, like, days after, I saw the proper rat.
And that's Louisa. We were living in a six-person share house. Pretty soon we all started seeing the rat. It would creep into the kitchen at night looking for food, and as soon as he saw one of us, he'd run and hide. We found his exits.
One is near the dishwasher underneath the sink. There was a little spot just wide enough for him to come in and out.
And he had like one specific place that he would come in and out from the cupboards.
The rat started to expand his domain. Jackie saw him hopping up the stairs to her bedroom.
And I remember just being like, oh shit, it's just having a run of the whole house. It was just getting more and more ballsy and less scared of people being in the space. And yeah, I just remember thinking, wow, okay, so it's like almost like another flatmate now.
I remember one day he ate like half of an avocado.
So Louisa covered the fruit bowl with a tea towel.
And the next day he ate the tea towel and the avocado. I was kind of like, okay, that's too much, eating our avocados.
The rat had to go, but we were determined not to kill it.
I have a feeling I was like all for rat bait, but then maybe people thought that was very unethical of me because apparently they die a really horrific death. But I know it's very effective.
So when Jackie suggests rat bait, we're pretty firmly against it because half the house, including me, are vegan. Our plan is to catch him and release him back into the wild. So Kat goes out and buys a couple of non-lethal traps. Basically, it's a tunnel that goes up into a ramp at one end. Hungry rat smells food, goes into the tunnel, up the ramp, the trap tips forward, closing the door behind him.
But this rat was far too clever for that trap. It was all over it and it didn't want to bar it.
That one fails. So Louisa and Josh put together trap number two.
Louisa and I set up the oldest trick in the book. We used a stick and a box with food under it and a string and stood at the other side of the kitchen. And it's that classic, goes in, grabs the snack, pull the stick, box lands on top.
Very kind of Elmer Fudd.
Oh man, directly inspired by some of those classic cartoons.
Every object is a possible booby trap.
We even did a paper trail. We did a little bits of snack leading towards the box and then just had to sit and wait. I remember the rat coming out from behind the dishwasher and would eat snack bit number one and then have a sniff around snack bit number two. And then maybe as far as snack bit number three. And then my recollection is that the rat would look at this box, give it a bit of a sniff.
I wonder, could this be one of them there booby traps?
And look me square in the eyes and give me a really buddy look. And he would just walk back in to whence he'd came.
Ain't no boob and I won't be trapped.
Mm. He was absolutely sharp as a tack.
Trap number three, the spinning bucket. I set this one up. Basically, you have a ramp for the rat to walk up to the rim of a bucket. And across the opening, you affix a roller of some kind. I had a roller suspended with wire, covered in peanut butter. So the idea is, rat goes up ramp, reaches out for the peanut butter, roller spins out from under his feet, rat falls in bucket.
I've never seen a rat eating peanut butter, though.
He didn't go for that one either.
This is what I was thinking. Because the house was mostly vegan, we didn't really try with cheese. We should have tried with cheese, no?
At this point, we've been trying to catch this rat for almost 6 months, and nothing has worked.
It managed to evade every trap.
We've tried to fix it a nice way and it's not working. But I was reluctant to be the harbinger of doom.
We still don't want to kill this guy, but we feel like we don't have a choice.
The solution wasn't just like, okay, you win, like do what you want.
Enough is enough, yeah.
Reluctantly, we switched to conventional rat traps. You know, those ones.
Do you remember if the rat traps worked?
Well, I know it mustn't have worked because I know how this story ends. Yeah.
One night, I come downstairs to the kitchen. I turn on the lights and I see the rat sitting on the kitchen counter. He's looking right at me. I'm looking right at him. We're both waiting to see what the other will do. I look to his nearest exit, underneath the dishwasher. He's closer than I am, but I think I can make it. I'm going to cut off his escape route. We both run to the dishwasher, and I beat him to it. He stops, turns around, and runs in the opposite direction, into the living room, under the couch. I've got him trapped. I know where he wants to go, so I put a bin next to the counter, leaving a tunnel. If he wants to get to his exit, he has to go through here. Then I take one of the rat traps, and I place it in that gap.
That's really mean. Poor thing.
I step onto the couch where he's hiding, very quietly, and I jump. And as soon as I hit the couch, he bolts for the kitchen.
Oh, yeah, you probably killed him with a heart attack first.
He runs straight through that gap that I made for him, and I hear the trap snap.
Oh, gosh.
But I can't see it anymore. Both the rat and the trap are gone.
Seriously? How come?
I go into the kitchen, and I see the trap. It's been flung through the air. Then I see the rat on the kitchen floor. He's not in the trap, and he's still alive.
Oh, my goodness.
But the trap has crushed his legs.
Oh, my God.
And he's just lying there, taking these heaving, deep breaths.
You can hear the soft swells of the string section coming in as this rat, with its glazed over eyes, lean to you and grab your lapel and pull you in and just say, "Tell my wife. There will be no crackling on the Christmas roast."
It's clear that he isn't going to go quietly. So there's this obvious rush to basically put him out of his misery. I search for a weapon. I find a kitchen knife.
I guess that's a common thing that people use to murder someone or something.
So I'm standing there holding this knife, looking at the rat, thinking about how I'm going to do this.
Imagine if any one of us came in at that moment and it's just you with this knife and just lights on. This madman holding a knife.
So yeah, I decide the knife is going to be too messy. I put it back. The easiest thing to do is to just whack it on the head, right? So I grab an empty beer bottle from the recycling. Just one hit, really hard, and it'll be done. He doesn't die.
Oh, fuck. Oh, God.
He goes into a seizure.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So I hit him again and again.
Oh, my goodness.
And I just keep hitting him.
Oh, my God. Did any blood come out?
You know, you have those moments where you start comparing your ideals to your behavior and the two don't really match up. This was one of those moments. I'd been a vegan for 8 years at this point. I never swat mosquitoes. I'm the kind of person who will go out of his way to catch a poisonous spider and place it safely outside. Standing there with the bloody beer bottle in one hand, having just pancaked this innocent rodent, I'm faced with the realization that I'm somehow also the kind of person who will bash a rat's brains in. And the feeling that I have in this moment is one of pure euphoria. 6 months of living with this rat, eating our food, chewing my bedroom carpet, cleaning up his shit. There's no remorse or sympathy, just the dopamine hit of knowing that this 6-month-long game of cat and mouse is over and I have won. It's a very uncomfortable thing to confront. To be so dedicated to preventing the suffering of animals, and then to get such a kick out of killing one, and to try to reconcile those two things. And then I just threw the poor guy in the bin.
Jesus, you didn't even make a proper hole on the ground for him with a little cross? Like,
would you have done that?
Yeah, probably.
What makes it feel worse is that Louisa, who's not even a vegetarian, wouldn't have killed the rat at all. I thought we were all out of options, that the rat had to die and the rest was just a matter of logistics. But Louisa was perfectly content to go on living with him in the house.
And was it actually nice? At least I had something else to look at instead of just looking at my phone while I was having dinner.
Well, in the beginning, he was a little bit afraid. Every move I would do, he would go inside, back inside. After, I don't know how much time, he started coming a little bit closer. And closer, at some point, he was just walking, like, around my feet. Also because, like, I was having dinner and all the food scraps that I would have left over from my dinner, I would give to him. For example, carrots, legumes, and vegetables. From now on, we were friends.
Louisa was feeding the rat.
Yeah, it would eat everything.
The whole time we were trying to trap it.
Her logic was that Well, if she fed it, it wouldn't eat our food. I didn't quite get that logic.
Instead of killing it or anything, I start giving him food scraps to avoid to eat the avocados. And how smart was it?
I thought we were all trying to get rid of the rat. And all this time, Louisa was treating it like a pet.
You make assumptions around like, oh, we all know what we need to do here, right? That you never even need to talk about it. And so when it comes out in such a blasé, like, oh, yeah, no, we've been feeding it. It's like, you've been what?
And maybe that's why the traps were not working. Because he was too full already. He couldn't be bothered to get into a trap, a dangerous situation for food. Walk up a ramp. Why would you do that? If you can have your phone neck, like, close to your door. But I didn't even realize that the rat would not come to the trap because of that. I'm just realizing now, to be honest.
If Louisa hadn't become friends with the rat, I would have never become its murderer.
Oops, Ryan, sorry. All that work for nothing.
That story was produced by Ryan Pemberton, with help from Eugenia Zubchenko and Sarah Mashman. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best Community Coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN Community Coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay is our social media producer, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find all of our episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe.